So I'm Dan Rundy. I hold the Schreier Chair here at CSIS. We're doing a Chevron forum around an exit interview with my friend Agnes Dashowitz. Agnes has over 20 years of experience in private equity and impact investing in emerging markets, and she most recently served as the director of the Office of Private Capital and Microenterprise at USAID, where she led the agency to design and implement several key initiatives at the nexus of commercial investment and development finance. I've known Agnes a long time. I've known you in several iterations of your career, I think. And I wanted us to have this conversation because I think the work you're doing is increasingly relevant. You were ahead of the curve on these issues 10 plus years ago, and now the sort of the rest of international development is following sort of the arc of your career. So it's great. I'm really pleased you've been able to join us. So thanks.
You.
And I'm very grateful to our friends at Chevron for hosting this as well. So what I wanted to do was, could you talk a little bit about just, you have a really interesting background. Could you just talk about how did you end up in international development? I suspect it has something to do with, you know, some of your distant past, but also some of the decisions you made in your career.
And I think some of the people I met along the way. I think that that's probably the biggest.
Where were you born?
So starting, I was born in Poland. I grew up in communist Poland, actually.
Really?
And which was a different experience than a lot of people here. And I came here when I was 12. And so I always had a little bit of an international spin on my life in general. But I really just wanted to be, from an early age, I was thinking, I'm going to be a lawyer. I'm going to be a lawyer. This is what I'm going to do. And frankly, what really drove me not to be a lawyer and to go into the international development space was really the fact that Eastern Europe changed over the course of my life. And the first job I ever got was really because I was Polish.
Really?
And because there was a fund being set up called, at that point it was called CARES Back, now it's called the Small
Enterprise Assistance Fund. So which, you were with CEIF before it was CEIF?
I was with CEIF before it was CEIF. I was the number two employee at CEIF.
Really?
Yes. And right after Tom Gibson, who was the original founder of CEIF, who when I first met him was still working for CARE, because actually CEIF grew out of CARE.
It was had to do with like agricultural commodity
money or
something?
Yeah, there was something, I don't remember exactly, but CARE was involved in some debt swaps in Latin America and ended up making a lot of money on that, which they did not expect. They really didn't know what to do with it. And that's when Eastern Europe really started opening up. And they said, hey, why don't we try to do something in Eastern Europe? And they decided we were going to start a small fund that's going to invest in SMEs, small and medium-sized enterprises in Poland. And I happened to graduate college at the same time. And I did a very short internship at the Polish embassy. Just because I really wanted to kind of give back to the country.
Sure.
And I spoke English and Polish, which was my only really great qualification at that point. And I met some Tom Gibson, who was happened to come to the Polish embassy for some event. And he said, hey, I'm really looking for someone to help me because we have to set up this fund. And you speak both languages, right? I mean, I really had
so
very
you're qualified.
Little experience. So I'm qualified. So I really fell into it. But it was really Tom Gibson and then several other people who I'll mention throughout the interview that really kind of planted the seed of international development through business. So international development that is really focused on sustainable solutions and business solutions and innovation and not just kind of typical aid, not grant dollars. So that was an idea that was early on planted in me.
So what year was this when you started working at CEIF?
93.
Okay.
So 93. That was really at the very beginning. Yeah.
You were at 12.
Yeah.
You were 12. Okay.
10.
13. Maybe 13. All right. So you were at night. Okay. So you were at, and did you have to move to Poland when you went to CEIF?
No, but I traveled there frequently.
So you were here in Washington.
I was here. We were the office, basically, Tom and myself, with the person who's now the head of CEIF, Bert Mandervaart.
So he was Bert, employee number three.
He was not an employee at the time. He was actually a pro bono legal counsel. He was a lawyer living in Brussels. So, I mean, but that was, you know, a complete stroke of luck that I fell into that crowd that was really interested in this.
And how long were you at CEIF?
I was there for about 4 years.
Okay, so just, till 97. And then, what happened then?
So I went to business school. So what happened was that with Seif, we started expanding, and we not only did the Poland fund, we started going into Russia and started thinking about the Balkan funds.
With Seif.
With Seif. That was.
And so you guys went to Seif. You took Seif went to AID and said,
"That's right.
Hey, this Poland thing worked out pretty well. You really ought to give us some money. And there's these problems in the Balkans." And we can help solve your problem.
Yeah, and they actually also went to USDA, who gave us a whole bunch of butter that then we had to sell to monetize and set up these funds, which was a whole different.
So they said, we don't have money for you, but we've got this butter.
Part of
and
my life was selling butter.
If you can sell the butter,
that's correct.
You can use it for others on the local market. You can use it for other stuff in local markets.
That's right. That is how a lot of early seed funds were funded.
That makes total sense to me.
It worked.
God, right.
Butter. Yeah, at some point we did think that we were going to raise the cholesterol levels of Bulgaria by high.
You probably did. If there's any obesity problems in your graduate countries from Seif, I blame you guys. You're going to have to make it right thing, you know,
or exactly.
Some lifestyle changes in Bulgaria.
I hear butter is okay now. So.
But that was butter.
That was a really interesting moment in my life so most of my activities were really not so much spent on investing. That was a team in Poland that was doing that, but really trying to seed these funds, trying to get other investors.
Stand them up, get other
investors. EBRD, USAID gave us some money for regional offices, lots of things about...
EBRD, the DFI, the region, put money into those funds?
Yes.
Okay. And so you were part of that, selling to folks like EBRD
exactly.
Saying, I've got this butter money, but I could use some real money. Could you give me some real money?
Exactly.
Right?
So the butter money was only the seed money. And then once the funds became really successful...
Popcorn kernel money. Sorry. I can't help myself.
Anyway, once it was really successful, though, CARE decided, oh, wait a minute, this is actually an investment business. We're a charity. We really can't be in it. Can you please disengage and take CARE out of the name?
Really?
Yeah. So we did. I set up a whole separate structure. Called it the Small Enterprise Assistance Funds, which was...
you came up with the name?
Debate. I don't think I was the one that came up with the name. I forgot. We probably paid someone to come up with
it's a good name.
It stuck.
So you helped stand up Seif and were there kind of in the first and second and third inning of Seif.
Right.
And then you went to business school.
Then I went to business school and actually did my internship in a business school with Seif in Poland.
Okay.
Helping them set up some regional offices.
Okay.
And then decided, you know, I really need some serious investment experience. Not that Seif was not doing it. I just was not part of it.
Right.
Seif was investing in the field. I was really investing. I was setting up more of the operational stuff. So I ended up going to Georgetown, mainly because I really wanted that international experience. And it was a really small program at the time.
Mm.
Loved my experience there. Huge Georgetown fan. Would recommend it to anyone. Mm. And then... got recruited by AIG.
AIG?
AIG.
AIG. The insurance company.
The insurance company.
Okay.
AIG was going into Poland.
You said you speak Polish and you've worked at Seif.
Exactly.
Sorry.
No, and actually the funny part is, so somebody, this is a long story, but I'll go a little
bit
into
time.
It. AIG was really interested in working with pension funds in Poland because they were privatizing pension funds. And that's what they recruited me for. But because I had this bug for small businesses, I turned that job down and I said, I really don't want to work with pensions. I want to invest in small businesses. And they said, oh, we're going to set up a fund in Poland. So why don't we connect you? And it so happened that the person that was running that fund also knew Seif and Tom Gibson. So he called me and said, you know, why don't you come and work for me? You move to Poland and let's start this fund. So then I became the number two employee at AIG's new private equity fund.
It sounds like a pattern.
It's a pattern.
It's a pattern. Agnes, I know you. This sounds like a pattern. So you're the second employee at the AIG Poland fund.
It was called the New Europe fund. It was actually a regional fund.
Okay.
And we invested in Romania, Bulgaria, Croatia.
And what kind of stuff did you invest in?
Lots of different things. My main specialties were financial institutions. So one of the things I did is I bought and sold a bank in Bulgaria.
Really?
And we sold it to the Greeks, which was a huge...
It seemed like a great idea at the time.
It was a great idea at
the
time. I'm sure that Bulgarian bank is fine.
Yeah, okay.
There were a lot of cultural issues between Bulgaria and Greece, so
Fantastic.
It was a big no-no, but the Greeks paid the best
they paid.
Price, so that was it. We also invested a lot in retail. The
really?
consumer spending was really growing in Eastern Europe at the time, so we invested in tons of retail, including malls in Hungary.
So where would the money come from for this new Europe fund? Who put
this was
money
a totally
into-
private fund.
So this was AIG money?
Yep. This was AIG actually did not put any money. They literally raised a private equity fund. It was the largest one at the time. It was over $300 million.
And this wasn't
all
IFC money?
Investors.
This wasn't EBRD
no.
money?
This was all private investors.
This was like Fidelity or CalPERS or...
This was, I forget who they were, Oppenheimer and other
okay,
people.
Okay, like raised,
yeah.
you know,
PIA
household
Pref,
names.
I mean, yeah.
Household right. names in the United States.
Household names in the United States.
Okay.
And mainly because AIG had other funds with them, and they trusted
yeah,
AIG.
People
to
trusted
go ahead
AIG.
And do it. Yeah. What was interesting then, and this is speaking back, I know we want to talk a little bit about DFIs. That's how I first became aware of DFIs, because at that point, IFC and EBRD were still very active in Eastern Europe. And we were the first private equity fund after Enterprise Partners that some of you may be familiar with, that USAID and the US government actually.
I want
set
to come
up.
Back to this, yeah.
Yeah. But AIG, as a private investor, actually had to compete with investments from IFC and EBRD, which drove us crazy. Because when you think about it, these DFIs have, you know, very different costs of capital than a private equity fund, and very different hurdle rates. So for us to compete with an investment from EBRD or from IFC was really difficult. And that's the first time I realized like what kind of role DFIs could or should not play in a lot of countries that are kind of moving, that are in transition from kind of development to growth.
How long were you at AIG's fund, the New Europe fund?
About 5 years.
In Poland?
Mm-hmm. Investing mostly outside of Poland.
Okay, and so then how did you end up, you came back to IFC?
Uh-huh.
And how did that happen?
So very quickly, I was learning a lot at AIG. I mean, I always tell people that going to business school is one thing, but actually learning how to invest, it's an apprenticeship, and you really have to do it to learn how to do it. And I did that. It was not easy. It was a lot of, especially because at that point, Eastern Europe was a little bit like the Wild West, and it was difficult to navigate a lot of not only unclear regulations, lots of corruption, lots of undue influence from different parties. It was an interesting time. But I learned a lot about how to invest in, on a private equity basis, which means investing in growth companies, sitting on boards, having a voice.
You did all that.
I did all that. And that was a great learning experience. But honestly, that bug that Steve planted in me of, well, how do you work with smaller businesses and how do you actually build economies and how do you build development? How do you help communities? That never left. So I just really got tired of private equity after a while. It's a really small, small crowd. It's not very interesting. You know, it's very driven by financial returns. So we had to do things like, you know, purchase large retail chains and then let hundreds of people go.
Sounds like fun.
It was not fun.
Yeah, I can't imagine.
So I really wanted to go back. So I said, well, now that I have this investment background, I really want to do something good with it. I want to go back to the roots. And I quit. And took whatever.
Did people say, like, what, leave Hollywood? Did people say that to you? Like, why
Some
are you doing this?
Some people said that, especially because at that point, Eastern Europe was really seriously booming.
Yeah.
And there were funds opening up all the time. First I moved to London, where I had lots of friends. And I said, well, maybe in London I could find something else to do. And I completely was being asked constantly to go back to Eastern Europe and to work on Eastern European funds. So I said, well, I'm not going to do that. And once again, Tom Gibson, the first person that hired me, happened to get a contract with IFC.
Doing technical assistance work
to set up SME funds in Africa.
And I'm going to guess who hired Tom Gibson.
Harold Rosen.
Yes.
It was Harold Rosen, another great person. And Liz Boorstin, sitting right here, another great person in my life who really just put me on the right path.
So Harold and Lewis said, "We know we need some technical assistance, so we're going to hire Tom." And
originally
Tom said,
"Originally it was just Tom." So I traipsed around Africa looking at SMEs in Africa
as part of his team. Yeah.
For Tom, he submitted that. Some of you might know of the business partners model, which is a SME investment model out of South Africa, which uses kind of revenue royalties to. For return instead of exits, and is a very successful one. So our recommendation out of that consulting assignment
experience
was seriously just to replicate the business partners model, which IFC did. And then I met Lewis Boorstin, who said, "Hey, we're setting up a new office at IFC, which will invest in impact businesses." At that point, impact investing was very early on. Most people really didn't understand it. But I think Harold and Lewis understood that there were some businesses that had double or triple bottom line impact, but they were still businesses, and that this was really the future of development. And they set up an office which within IFC, which would invest in those businesses. And I think that that was truly visionary.
What was the office called?
It was called the Grassroots Business Initiative.
Okay. And was that anti-DNA for IFC, that office?
It was anti-DNA. It was anti-DNA.
In what sense?
It was anti-DNA. The first thing that was odd about it, I mean, IFC was all about impact. They liked that a lot. They liked that we could count numbers of women and environmental impact and so on. But getting really small transactions out the door through a process that normally takes, you know, $10 million, a minimum transaction, and we were doing transactions of $250,000, was incredibly difficult.
The system was set up for sort of 5 or 10 million or 15 or 50 million transactions.
Exactly.
And you get rewarded at IFC, IFC or any DFI, there's a high premium on pushing a lot of money out the door. It's called a volume culture, right? So this is almost like the anti-cult. This is an all anti-cultural
That's
act, right?
And you know, not only that, I think that it was just they were not used to this, to looking at these kinds of businesses, which were, I mean, as an example, you know, we invested in a company in Swaziland that paid local women to make baskets, right? And that was, they exported these baskets. It was great, but this was not a kind of business that IFC was used to. They were used to looking at, you know, large infrastructure
a telecom
projects.
Company
you know,
in
at
Brazil
the same time that we were doing Swaziland baskets, they were doing, you know, the
Afghan
hydro dam
in
Uganda, right?
Yeah.
So it was very kind of different. But there was a lot of interest in it, and I think that's really thanks to Harold Rosen, who kind
And Peter Voigt was
pushed,
supportive.
Yeah, exactly.
The CEO of IFC at the time, who's a senior advisor here at CSIS. Was supportive of what Harold and Lewis were trying to do.
That's right. That's right.
Otherwise, I don't think it would have happened.
No, I don't think so either. Yeah. No, that's right.
Okay, so were you employee number three at this organization?
No, there were several people, actually. Was it like five, six, seven, maybe?
Employee number
small.
Five.
It was pretty
okay,
small.
Employee number five. All right, so you joined the Grassroots Business Fund.
Initiative. Within IFC.
Okay, and so then what happened?
Then what happened was that we figured out we really can't do this inside this huge organization. Like, we were getting lots of, you know, invited to speak a lot and talk a lot about what we do, and everybody was kind of celebrating us. But there was really not, we were not doing a service to the companies that we were really trying to invest in, because they had to comply with requirements that large corporations would have to comply with and deal with lawyers from IFC that, you know, would negotiate very difficult deals.
Yeah, big telecom.
Was, yeah, this was usually the first investment that these companies were ever taking on. So there was a bit of a mismatch of culture and process, right? And Harold said, well, why don't we try to spin this out? Why don't we try to take this activity and literally establish an independent not-for-profit and a for-profit kind of a hybrid structure outside of IFC and the World Bank. So we went to the World Bank board and asked them to do it, and amazingly, they agreed. They agreed that we can go outside. They'll give us some funding. We can even take some of the portfolio with us and basically establish a not-for-profit that would raise donations to, you know, like not-for-profits do, to basically provide technical assistance to these companies and to operate, and a small fund that would be a for-profit fund. I think the first fund we raised was about $20 million. That where the not-for-profit would be a general partner of the fund, it would manage the fund, and the fund would do what we used to do at IFC, which is invest less than $1 million at a time.
But also provide advice. So
but also
a combo
advice,
of investment and advice.
So that's the technical assistance that was funded to a not-for-profit, to the not-for-profit, because otherwise we really wouldn't be able to provide that advice, and those businesses need a lot of advice.
Okay. So you then got a phone call. Somebody called you and said, hey, we want you to come back into public service. And they said, can you come to the U.S. government? How did that happen?
I ran into someone in a garage.
Oh, so God, really?
I'm not making this up.
This is fantastic.
So I went to, a conference.
Yeah.
And I
hope one of mine. No.
Actually, I don't remember where it was, honestly. And I was waiting for my car in the garage, and John Basilewski, who was someone that set up the...
also an affiliate here at CSI.
Exactly. He set up the guarantee scheme at USAID.
The Development Credit Authority.
Development Credit Authority.
Yeah.
Very successful. He somehow recognized me and said, you're Agnes. I want to talk to you. And I said, well, what do you want to do? And he said, we're setting up a new office in the Africa Bureau because we realized that... we really need to work with investors a lot more strategically and not just reactively. So how can USAID start designing better processes, better structures, start supporting investors and not just doing our own programming? And he said, would you want to try this out? And after a lot of deliberation, because honestly, we were raising our second fund.
This was at the Grassroots Business Fund that had spun out of IFC.
I decided to do it. We closed the fund, and I left right after we closed the fund, which the investors were not pleased with, but they live with it. Mm. but it was really an amazing experience. And then, it was a very different world for me. Right?
How long were you at AID?
6 years.
Okay, so what did you do?
I started out, by the way, thinking I was going to be there for about two.
Right. And were you a political or were you a Schedule B?
I was literally every kind of
PSC, RASA, PASA.
So if anybody wants to know what kind of mechanisms there are at USAID,
there are like 23
people,
of them.
I haven't been all 23, but I've been about five.
That's a lot. In 6 years, you were five?
Yeah. But
that's impressive.
Yeah, at the end, I was a civil servant, which was the ultimate goal. But it was, it was really, first of all, a huge learning experience, right? I had never worked for, IFC was big, but USAID is
bigger,
right? It's bigger. It's more complicated. It is very driven, obviously, for obvious reasons, by political imperatives. So the fact that administrations change, I happen to work under one administration, but people changed anyway. And priorities change, sectors change. I did have the good fortune, once again, to meet a couple of amazing people, John being one of them, but also Raj Shah, the head of USAID, who were really aligned with the way I was thinking about it, meaning that how do we work through the private sector?
So when you went into AID through whichever door you went through first, what was the job? What was the role? Was it to help us figure out how to get more private capital in Africa?
Yes, that was the goal. And the role was really, let's set up a small office inside the Africa Bureau that would go out there and help local offices, which we call missions, to interact with investors and to set up programs to kind of imbue investment into the normal programs that we have.
Tell a couple of stories of the kinds of things you've did in that role, like a couple of projects you funded.
Right. So one of them was a fund in Uganda that was an agricultural fund. It's called Pro Capital, where what they did is they wanted to just invest in small SMEs in Uganda and in the region, and they wanted to raise private funds. The problem was that, and they had a lot of interest, for example, from JP Morgan, from their social investment arm, except JP Morgan could not convince their investment committee that agriculture in Eastern Africa was really something that where they would get results. The impact everyone got, but not the financial results.
I was in Uganda 2 months ago, and they told me that if you could get your act, Uganda gets agricultural act together, it could have four times the amount of agricultural productivity
that
it has now.
Correct. So What we did is we went to the guarantee office that we worked with really closely, and we asked them if they would guarantee the investment from JP Morgan into this fund, and they did. So JP Morgan ended up putting long-term debt instead of equity, and it was 50% guaranteed, and that actually got the investment committee of JP Morgan over the hurdle of, yes, we should take this risk. And it was really the first time I think JP Morgan invested in Africa.
What did you do for that fund? Did you say, I will help pay for keeping the lights on? You weren't making an equity investment or a loan,
right,
or a guarantee to the fund. What you were doing is helping kind of keep them all alive and say, I'm going to help pay. Was it Dinesis to pay this?
Yeah, it was a guarantee
a development
to JP
credit?
Morgan. Yeah, development credit guarantee.
So you
that we negotiated.
Okay, so you helped structure a transaction, use the Development Credit Authority instrument at AID, and that gave comfort to JP Morgan.
Right. Because traditionally what DCA had been doing is really guaranteeing portfolios of banks that were lending to new sectors. This was one of the first times that they actually guaranteed an investment in a fund vehicle. So that was the first one. Another interesting thing I did was through a local program in Ethiopia that we had, which was an agribusiness, it was a Feed the Future program. We supported a company, a little organization called Renew, which set up an angel investment fund in Ethiopia, which brought money in from angels in places like Delaware and Colorado. So angel investors are individuals that would be investing small amounts in early stages of a company. And they are now investing. I forget how many investments they have, but it's at least 16. They invested, for example, in a company in Ethiopia that exports injera bread to Washington, D.C. So if any of you have eaten injera in D.C., it's probably from there. But basically, it's all funded through angels, funneled through this organization in Ethiopia. And not only does this organization bring in all that investment into Ethiopia, they actually, because it was the first time that the Ethiopian government had to deal with kind of equity investment, they literally had to teach the finance industry of Ethiopia what that meant and what these investments looked like. So
you paid for that?
We paid for that.
So it wasn't, they didn't come to you and say, give me money for the fund. It was, I need to train up a whole sector,
yes,
to understand,
exactly,
what the heck is this thing.
Exactly.
So sometimes it's about a guarantee, like a development credit authority. Sometimes it's about, hey, investment sector in Ethiopia, there's this thing called making investments, and here's the ABCs of how you do that, right?
Exactly, that's okay. Right. So that's what we call technical assistance. It's actually literally setting up the structures, which is usually the thing that most people don't want to pay for.
And it's super not glamorous.
It's super not glamorous.
Right?
And you don't get a lot of credit.
And so you go and you do like a seminar for like, and it's like, it's, you know, it's in a hotel room,
that's
conference
right,
room for like 2 weeks, and then people say, oh, but
yeah,
but it's super it's necessary, right?
Another thing we did, by the way,
I want to talk about, yes, third, MITA.
Yes.
I want to talk about MITA.
So MITA is interesting, but MITA,
what is MITA?
So MITA is a partnership with U.S. pension funds. It's an organization. I'm going to backtrack a little bit, because when I first started at USAID, one of the first things we did is we noticed that the Kenyan pension fund industry was growing, meaning that the society was really getting more wealthy. People were starting to save for their retirement, and there were all these pension funds that were amassing huge amounts of money, but they were only allowed to invest in the stock market or internationally, which either A, took money out of the country, or B, just completely crowded the stock market, which is tiny, with all this money. And that's not good for the stock market. It's not good for the pension funds, because if everything falls apart, both are dead. So what happened was that we provided training to pension funds in Kenya about private equity. So we said, you need to diversify. This is what investing in private equity is all about. And the regulators came to that training, learned about private equity. And as a result, they actually allowed pension funds to make a small allocation of up to 5% of their overall.
Okay. So let me just stop you right there.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of conversation in Washington right now about, we need a new DFI. Mm-hmm. And we need to do private sector investment. Well, there's a lot of unglamorous, boring stuff to to set the table for that to happen, right?
That's right.
So this is stuff like, I need to like explain all this kind of stuff, this clunky plumbing stuff that you're talking about, that's really important, and it's not glamorous. It's not the telecom investment that gets 5X in equity and all this stuff. All the setting the table stuff is this stuff, right?
Yes. It's literally helping local markets develop. Right?
This is a public good. Is this an AID function, or is this a D? If you were at the let's take it to the World Bank. Is this something IFC would do? Is this something the World Bank would do?
You know, to me, it's something they should do jointly.
Yeah.
And the reason is because just like OPIC and USAID or IFC and the World Bank, I think both have very interesting capabilities. So, for example, when you look at building of local capital markets, obviously IFC should be doing that because they know investors. They understand what investors need. But yet the World Bank is really or USAID, that really has the trust, the local presence, and the trust of the local government.
They're in 80 countries and they've been there for decades.
On the policy side, right?
They do that all the time. IFC and the bank do it all the time.
Yeah. They do it together?
Well, they can do it together. I mean, when I opened Vietnam for IFC, one of the things we did is send people to write leasing legislation so you could have a leasing business.
Yeah,
exactly.
We work really closely with the World Bank to make this happen. So it does happen.
Okay.
Yeah. Exactly.
Good.
So I think that's right. And I think that's really the USAID new DFI relationship.
They need to make beautiful music together.
They need to work on things
like leasing markets, new privatizing pension funds, creating a venture capital industry, creating a stock market. How about let's talk about MITA though, because we hosted Donna Sims Wilson, who is the head of the National Association of Securities Professionals, 2 weeks ago at our Global Development Forum. Mm-hmm. And she talked about her partnership with the idea, which you were the architect of. So what is that and why is that important?
Right. So at USAID, we had this great group of people that advised us called the Partners Forum, which included another mentor of mine, Dale Mathias, but also her husband, Ed Mathias, who is from Carlyle. And Carlyle raises tons of money from pension funds. So when we started talking about pension funds, I kind of said to him, why do you think U.S. pension funds are not really interested in a lot of these emerging markets?
This was your conversation with Ed Mathias?
Yeah, who knows a lot about this. And he said, look, you know, these pension funds, U.S. pension funds operate very differently.
Yeah.
They don't have money to travel. They have very small staff. And they're all governed by these advisors.
Right. So this is I'm the fire department of Philadelphia.
Yes. So you
and I am sitting on $1 billion with a B in Pennsylvania.
And I want to have some returns.
And I've got a board of eight people. There's an eight-person board, and there's a very limited public sector budget.
That's right.
And they're probably not super excited about, like, we'd really like you to go to Africa to kind of traipse around and see what you can do with $1 billion. Is that basically what the problem is?
Yeah. And even though they hear a lot about emerging markets, they hear a lot about, oh, they're, you know, potential returns, if you take the right risk, if you have the right partners, da, da, da. So they were interested in it. They just really could not afford to do anything about it.
These are, in essence, civil servants in city government who've worked up to government, who've worked their way up into a position of trust.
Exactly.
And so if you've been in the public sector before, you know how hard it is to get travel money, or it's sort of frowned on to kind of do any of that kind of stuff. So they don't have, as many of these folks have never, not because they're not super bright or super competent or super professional people, they just haven't had the opportunity to go to Africa, and that what their only exposure to emerging markets is what they see on television.
Exactly.
Is that a fair statement?
But we saw huge potential because, you know, the African pension funds that I mentioned are growing really fast. They do know what's happening in Africa, and they have the pipeline. The problem is they really don't have a lot of that expertise of what it takes to invest. Meanwhile, the pension funds in the U.S. do, right? Like, those are the people that know how to invest in infrastructure. They know how to invest in funds. So we thought, like, if we bring them together, they can co-invest, and they can also share that experience and those skills. So that's what MITA was. What happened was that we approached this association that Donna is the head of now, called the National Association of Securities Professionals, which is basically an association of minorities and women working in the U.S. pension fund industry. So you have everyone from, like, the CIO of CalPERS to a trustee of the Fireman of New Orleans pension fund.
How much money is the U.S. pension fund industry? How much money are they sitting on?
I think...
As she told me, $9 trillion.
Yeah, it's trillions.
So $9 trillion.
But also, when you look at it, the reason people are interested now in emerging markets is because something like $30 trillion of pension fund money worldwide is earning negative returns right now because the developed countries, the developed markets are really not growing. So everyone is looking for emerging markets, but they're thinking, you know, everyone's like, oh my God, my pension. But right. How do you actually gain some returns over the long term? And really, emerging markets is it. So this was a partnership that brought these people to, lots of people from these U.S. pension funds, to Africa, got them to meet companies, the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, kind of showed them that there's a whole financial market out there, make them more comfortable
educate
with it.
Educate them on the opportunity.
Educated them. Introduced them to people who are raising funds. Mm-hmm. And as a result, most recently, the city of San Francisco made its first pension fund, made its first investment in an infrastructure fund focused on Africa.
How much would they put in?
I think they're putting in $100 million.
Okay, so the whole project that you financed was $2 million bucks?
Less than that.
Okay, so less than $2 million, and it's led to at least $300-400 million.
That's just the first investment.
That's
right.
But there's at least a couple others.
Yeah.
That are either in the pipeline or are going to happen.
Correct.
So a $2 million investment from AID, which is like a public good, to educate investors, decision makers who sit on trillions of dollars of money on this huge opportunity in Africa, has led to hundreds of millions of dollars in U.S. capital flowing into Africa. So everyone talks about this in theory. You made it happen in practice.
And actually, some good is coming out of it for U.S. businesses as well, because as a result of starting to share knowledge, the Nigerian, I'm not sure if it's a pension fund or the sovereign wealth fund, actually hired an advisor from Houston to help it invest some of its money in the U.S. So
right.
It's a very interesting
This isn't your grandparents' developing world anymore, right?
Yeah.
They got sovereign wealth funds. They can invest over here, too.
That's right.
So it's a two-way street.
Yeah, it's a two-way street. And I really think that's the future of development. It's really, and that's why I'm excited about the new DFI. Because I think it's the U.S. has a lot to bring to these markets, and these markets have a lot to bring to the U.S.
So could you spend 1 minute on, I'm going to testify before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee tomorrow about the new DFI. So could you just spend 1 minute on how should AID and the new DFI make beautiful music together in this area?
I think my one suggestion that I've been really harping on is that for the DFI to be successful, it has to have local presence.
Okay.
You cannot invest in any of these countries from Washington, D.C. You really have to understand what's going on. It's really not efficient to build a whole new local presence. By the time you get people, by the time you put them in place, there are lots of people at USAID who are incredibly interested. I've worked with these people who know about investments, who are enthusiastic about this, who have experience. Some of them have come from the private sector. Who would love to
be deputized,
you know, where they already are to work with this DFI. Because I think that that's how you, first of all, combine the two. I mean, it's not an easy marriage. I did Power Africa. I totally understand. It's not so easy to work together. But you almost have to, because this can't just be about transactions and about just bringing more money and investing more money. This has to be about building local partnerships.
And that's where AID comes in.
And you have to be present. AID, first of all, we have a history in a lot of these countries.
Yeah, 30 or 40 years of relationships.
Yeah, exactly. We have people who, yeah, they rotate, but they really know what they're doing.
Yeah, we have FSNs. We have Foreign Service Nationals.
And they would love to do it because they also feel this is the future of development.
Okay, but so Agnes, if someone said to you, AID needs to do private sector development, what that means is the kinds of things you've been describing.
Yep.
The kinds of things like the NASP transaction or the training in Ethiopia or the changes in the pension fund rules in one of the other countries you were talking about or the guarantee you did in Uganda. In essence, AID helps set the table for the kinds of investments that a new DFI will make. Is that a fair way to describe it?
That's right. And it can also work alongside of the new DFI, right? So a DFI wants to invest in a leasing company in Kenya, and there's no leasing law, then USAID
can
start
that.
Working. I mean, that presumes a lot of flexibility of programming on USAID's part, but maybe that's something to ask for
you
in addition
work
to
for.
Setting up the DFI, right? I mean, because those two things have to work together. I think that it's, but the people are really important.
Okay.
I think hiring a whole bunch of new people just makes no sense.
All right, this is awesome. I'm so glad we're doing this. All right, so what are you doing now?
So I'm
I can't believe you left us. You left AID. You're killing me because you did such fabulous things while you were there. So what are you doing now?
So what I'm doing is I decided to take all my experience in emerging markets and apply it to the U.S. So in the U.S., we're facing a lot of issues. There are a lot of underserved communities, impoverished communities. Some people don't know, hookworm is back in Alabama. So we are really seriously facing...
Like the weird tropical disease?
Like the thing that Rockefeller Foundation
got rid of like in the 30s or something?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
It's... Poverty in the U.S. is really amazing, and I've decided to try to take a lot of the learnings, a lot of this blended capital, a lot of this technical assistance approaches that we've talked about, to figure out how do you catalyze investment and business solutions to addressing some of these issues. I applied for a fellowship at the Rockefeller Foundation and got it. So for the next 2 years, I'm literally thinking through what are some of the new structures and new ideas to increase investment in communities that really need it in places like Alabama.
Well,
like
I want to make an open
Nebraska.
Invite to you now. Like, if you want to do roundtables here, I'll have you do that.
Awesome.
If you want to publish things as you're learning stuff, we want to do
Would
that
love
for
it.
You.
Great.
Okay.
I really think there's a lot to learn.
That's amazing.
And some people in this country don't want to hear it, but the same issues that we find in emerging markets exist here.
Well, look, I think this is fabulous. Look, there's a lot of smart people here. A lot of your fan club is here.
Awesome.
I'm president of your
Thank
fan club.
Thank you for showing up. You guys
of course.
Are great.
But could we? I'd love to bunch a couple of questions from her friends, fans, and colleagues for Agnes. I'd love to hear from Louis Burstyn. And I'd love to hear from this woman back there. Why don't we? And who else? Let's get one other person, please. Okay, we'll just go with, and this gentleman there. So Louis, this woman here, and the gentleman back there. Okay, we'll bunch them together, World Bank Group style.
So you mentioned Power Africa, uh-huh. but you didn't talk about specifically what you learned from that. Can you
talk
about that?
That was a big chunk of my life.
Yeah, can you talk about...
What is Power Africa and what did you learn?
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay, this woman back here. And name, rank, and serial number, please. And keep the question short.
Joanne Manrique, I head up the Center for Global
All
Health
right.
and Diplomacy. One quick question for you as you are working in the local markets. Now there's a call in terms of doing investments for minority communities and really incentivizing small, medium enterprises and funds to grow into minority communities tax-free. So I'd like to hear your thoughts on that and could those structures work that you know are being played around right now?
Okay, and this gentleman over here. Name, rank, and serial number. Keep it short.
Dan Silverstein. I'm a private sector and capital markets advisor. This gentleman here stole my question. But I had an aspect of the question of talk more about Power Africa that relates to something you told me once. When I was a contractor at USAID and I had a responsibility for bringing together various federal agencies in something called the Interagency Transactions Group, and found it difficult to find comity among them. And you talked very passionately about trust and how one of the elements of success in Power Africa was directly derivative of the trust that was created among the players of the federal agencies. If you talk to that, I think it would be interesting.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Okay, so let me start with Power Africa and then I'll go on to the other question. Power Africa was President Obama's initiative to deliver 30,000 megawatts of power to sub-Saharan Africa. And it was the first I wouldn't say the first. I think the Feed the Future initiative was kind of the first, but this was really the biggest partnership where USAID went out to companies, asked them what issues they were facing when trying to deliver power on the continent, and tried to bring all the agencies together and try to cater its USAID programs to address those issues. So I was actually fairly surprised first at the response we got from the companies because, you know, the overwhelming feeling within USAID was when the government reaches out to companies like GE, they just recoil because they don't really want to have anything to do with the government. Actually, they welcomed our call because they were really interested in how we can help them overcome these obstacles. And a lot of those obstacles were issues of trust. So a lot of those obstacles were... The government of Kenya did not have the ability to figure out if the term sheet that they were getting from GE for a new power plant was equitable or not.
And they was really a fair deal? Was this a good deal or not?
Right, and they needed independent advisors, which then we would provide.
So AID funded, so on the so when they were negotiating with GE, AID would say, I will pay for, and they trusted
transaction
AID.
Transaction advisors, yeah.
I will pay for a transaction advisor to sit with you on your side of the table to look at the contract and ask the right kinds of questions, right?
Right.
Isn't that basically
That's correct.
You did?
That's basically what we did.
Okay.
Then we moved on to doing off-grid power solutions, which is called Beyond the Grid, which was very successful as well because we quickly realized that the large power solutions were only going to address a very small sector, and we really needed to look at what could be done outside of the utility sector. And it, you know, people ask me all the time what I think was the biggest success of Power Africa. And I always say the biggest success of Power Africa was the ability for us to bring together not only other federal agencies, but also other multilaterals like the World Bank, the Swedish Development Agency, to row in the same direction. Because what happened was that everyone was interested in power in Africa to some extent, but everybody was giving, you know, was working in a silo, and often these governments would get contradicting advice. So IFC would be telling the government to do one thing and USAID something else, and the Swedes would be pushing this towards something else. So because we started bringing people together and kind of agreeing and debating among ourselves, we were able to present very clear ideas to the countries, which, believe me, they appreciated. Now, on their intergovernment group, which I think is another huge success because...
What does that mean, intergovernment
basically
group?
Every single U.S. government agency would meet on Power Africa on a weekly basis. So we, and this was really, I have to thank the White House for that because that's, you know, the NSC is really the only power
this
that...
This was Gale?
This was Gale, this was Matthew Farnham Schneider who worked for Gale.
Okay.
He basically called all the agencies and we started meeting with all the agencies. We, USAID ended up chairing the meetings because we
you had
putting
the, field
the whole
presence.
Program together. We had the field presence. But everybody was there. OPEC would host it just so we would kind of have equal footing. But we would have, you know, the Army Corps of Engineers would show up, right? Peace Corps would show up. So everybody was showing up. And what we did is we decided to go country by country, and everybody would report on their activities so that we could coordinate better. And the reason that worked was really because, you know, at first they made us meet, right? Nobody was like, oh my God, another meeting, and we have to come up with an agenda. But over time, we became friends. We really started
those
working together
Those people at OPEC
well.
Weren't so bad.
Exactly. Treasury, you know, Treasury was there. And
those bureaucrats at aid aren't so bad either, right?
Exactly, right? So everybody started really getting along, and we would, you know, I remember when we had, you know, people leaving Power Africa, we would have these going away parties, and there'd be tons of people there from all different agencies. And I really think that helped build, you know, build a group that really worked together well. So we would just pick up the phone and call each other. Right, and say, hey, what do you guys know about this deal or that deal? How can we help it? And I think that was really huge.
I think the Power Africa initiative was one of the great innovations of the Obama administration, and I think it's something that is a great idea. The story I heard was that Mike Froman was in Africa and saw that the Chinese were eating our lunch as it pertained to energy and said we need to do something about that. Now, it was good for development, but it was also there was a little bit of a geostrategic push. That sound about right?
I've had a lot.
Maybe it's apocryphal, but
I came in right after that.
Okay, so you weren't here.
I was
for
not
that.
Part of that trip.
You weren't part of that story.
No,
okay,
no.
All right, but But you have heard that you might have heard something like that.
I might have heard something like
okay,
that.
Okay, that's what I thought. Okay. So I'm looking around.
Oh, I want to answer one more question really fast about the minority investment
please,
in the U.S.
Please.
So I think what you're referring to is the Investing in Opportunity Act, which allows investors to place realized capital gains into places called opportunity zones, which are low-income tracts in the U.S. I think a lot of creativity will really need to be deployed to make that work. The reason being is that it's pretty tight legislation, meaning that you have to reinvest those capital gains in 180 days, which means that a typical fund structure will not work. And people are thinking through that. The biggest issue that I see is that people are thinking of, oh, I'm just gonna use the money to invest in small businesses, or I'll just do an infrastructure investment. All of that needs to happen together. So for these zones to really emerge out of poverty, You really need to start thinking about the same way we thought about Power Africa, right? What are the policy level things that need to happen? How do you lower transaction costs for the investors in those opportunity zones? How do you bring in technical assistance for the small businesses? Because they must need it, otherwise investors would be investing in them already. How do you build infrastructure like broadband, co-working space, affordable housing that enables those communities to thrive? So it's not a one answer that's going to, you know, just sticking a small business investment fund in an opportunity zone is not going to solve poverty there. You really have to build ecosystems, and that's a much longer term job. I think it's a great idea, and I'm working on trying to figure out how to do that, but it's not a one size fits all answer.
Okay, I'm going to take two more questions. This gentleman here and Bob Wirtz, please. Use the microphone. Use the microphone.
Formerly at USAID, I was in charge of private sector development for sub-Saharan Africa, set up the Southern Africa Enterprise Fund, and also funded the OPIC Fund. We run into a lot of obstacles getting those going and the success. What were the most difficult challenges that you had setting up the funds that you set up? And what, I'd much rather look at successes than failures, but what would you say your batting average was?
Okay, let me just get Bob Wirtz here too, please.
Thank you. I'm Bob Wirtz. I am associated with CSIS,
yep.
And I was formerly with USAID. And Agnes, you'd mentioned that early in your career that you were annoyed that the IFC was competition for the private sector funds. You can see that the DFI might also play the role of being competition with the private sector. What is it that the DFI shouldn't do?
Okay. I'll answer that one first just because it's an easy answer. I am very hesitant about the DFI being able to make grants. I think that you should stick to what you're good at. OPIC is good at investment. It has a lot of really great people. And I think mixing grants into that is really scary to me because it's difficult to make a decision as an investment officer whether you should invest or make a grant. Making grants is a lot easier. And I think that that's something that should be considered very carefully. I think
there's
these
generally
lanes
two systems, two cultures. Yeah. There's conflicts of interest. If I'm the investment officer and I have access to the grant kitty, mm-hmm. I'm going to grab it every time I can.
That's right.
Right?
That's right. And I think that that's, if that is the case, the lanes need to be very well defined, right? At IFC, we used to have ability to do both, and I think that kind of, you'll agree, sometimes works.
No, actually, I actually disagree with what you just said.
Okay, good.
Okay.
All right, Louis, don't say anything. But I think that should be considered. If anything, it should be really well managed. I think it's difficult.
I mean, if I think about the way IFC is currently organized or the way FMO or CDC, the way I understand it is there's a big separation between the kinds of folks who make those
decisions. What I'm saying
is
if USAID is able to do grants and be flexible to support the DFI, then you don't need that function as well.
I have a hard time imagining that the new DFI is going to want to mess around with the federal acquisitions rules, the FAR, or the IG, or leader with associates. I mean, they're going to, what is technical assistance going to look like for the new DFI? It's going to be, I need someone who speaks French and Wolof to sit in some windowless office for 3 months, helping put together an Excel spreadsheet for SME loans in some bank I've never heard of, and then run a training in some hotel room for 2 weeks. That's what TA looks like. So you're going to need some kind of body shop to say, I need somebody who's worked on three of these projects to get on a plane and go do that, right?
Right.
That walks and quacks like the kinds of stuff AID does every day. And they're going to find, I don't really want to, or they're going to say, I cannot imagine the new DFI saying, I'm going to make a cut dozens of $100,000 checks to pay for all this stuff. They're going to say, this is for the birds, the level of crap that's involved in actually doing some teeny $100,000 grants. They're going to say, no, I'm going to bunch this all together. And it's going to walk and quack like large, multi-solution grants that AID manages. And they're going to say, I don't want to do this. And they're going to end up wanting to hand it over to AID. That's
right.
What I think.
Right. I think it's reinventing the wheel.
Yeah.
So I totally agree.
Okay. All right. Well, okay. Anybody else?
A question on the failures.
Yeah.
I don't know what my batting average was. It wasn't that high.
There were no failures.
I mean, I came up with tons of ideas that I've chosen to forget, that I tried to push through that did not work. And honestly, the biggest challenge was that you know, USAID's money is very siloed in that it's not only siloed by sector, it's also siloed by country. So unless you have the perfect deal that is agriculture in Kenya, it's really difficult to do anything about it. That, I would say.
It's so frustrating. Aid is full of great ideas. Aid is full of great ideas.
Okay. Good. Okay. Well, listen, I think I know there's a whole series of friends and family who want to chat with you, Agnes. Will you come back, please?
Yeah, absolutely.
This was
love
great.
It.
Would you guys please join me in thanking Agnes for doing this? Thank you.
Thank you, Ben.
Great. Okay.